The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, I talked to someone today who reminded me or told me, I don't quite remember very well the conversation, that he had come to me some many months ago and said that something like he was wondering whether it was okay to be happy. And I said that from the point of view of Buddhist spirituality, that it's essential to be happy. There's no liberation without happiness. And that remark apparently struck very deep for him. And he's been pondering it ever since, and challenged by it ever since, and came back to talk about it 8 months later. So to be happy, is it okay to be happy? Is it reasonable to be happy? And do we have the conditions to be happy? Is it available to us to be happy? Or is it, are we better off being miserable? the Buddhist path, in Buddhism there's kind of two general ways of seeing Buddhist practice or Buddhist spiritual life. And one is from the point of view of skillful means, that there are various skillful means, various, some people call it techniques, for developing a spiritual life, leading to freedom, liberation, love. And the other side, the other approach, it can be called the wisdom approach. And the wisdom approach in its pure form doesn't focus much on technique at all, but rather focuses on something that's various things that we can call wisdom, some particular understanding, particular insight into things. And sometimes the wisdom approach is so thorough that it undercuts, it pulls the rug underneath any attempt to do technique, to do skillful means. Because a skillful means and technique approach, it's a goal-like practice usually. You know, you do certain things so that in the future you can attain something. You can change yourself, you can become something a little bit different. You can develop your concentration, you can develop stages of insight, you can develop, make yourself into a better person, into a kinder person, into a more loving person, a more enlightened person, a more concentrated person. You can do all these things, kind of change yourself and attain. And the wisdom approach sometimes in its strongest versions will say that all that is just a bunch of foolishness to do that. And that there's no real point in pursuing that. If you're pursuing any kind of attainment, you're actually missing the boat. You're missing the possibility of being happy and free right now. And in most schools of Buddhism, you find within the school or within the particular tradition, kind of the skillful means camp and the wisdom camp. Some people say, you know, really put their emphasis, all their eggs in the basket of skillful means. It's really what's important. And other people who kind of put everything in much more in the basket of wisdom. And sometimes these two people don't get along, these two school camps. And sometimes someone comes along and figures out how to hold them together in a way that they're compatible and harmonious. But what I want to talk about today is the wisdom approach, because I think it's very important for me, and for those people for whom wisdom is accessible, this wisdom approach is accessible, it lends itself to being much happier while we do the practice. The skillful means approach, the technique approach, for those who are not very skillful in using it, can cause a lot of misery. Boy, oh boy. You know, in all kinds of ways. You know, first of all, you're not good enough. You don't have the ability to get to do the technique. You can't get concentrated enough. And so you beat yourself up for not fulfilling, you know, this wonderful spiritual technique. Or maybe you are successful at fulfilling it. You go on a long retreat and you're able to get good and concentrated and you feel really good about yourself. And then you can't hold on to it. It goes away. And then you feel miserable because it's not there anymore. And then you compare yourself to your neighbors. Maybe you attain a little bit on that retreat or in that sitting, but the person sitting next to you, they got a little bit further in the technique. And, you know, and maybe the people, a lot of people around you did a lot better. Maybe you're in the bottom 10% of people in that technique. And so, you know, there's comparisons that can be made. And often it lends itself to the idea of always postponing the ultimate goal. So always postponing one's life, real happiness, and saying, well, in the future, some point, when I do enough of this stuff, when I've gotten enough merit, gotten enough technique, gotten kind of done my duty, at some point in the future, perhaps I can maybe attain something. The skillful as a means approach sometimes lends itself to aggrandizing the spiritual path. You know, religious people are great at mythologizing their religion. And one of the things they mythologize is the grandeur of what enlightenment might be. And you can actually watch in the history of Buddhism enlightenment getting more and more mythologized in history, getting bigger and bigger and bigger until, you know, it's not attainable for any mere human being. It's only maybe, you know, in some future lifetime, you know, perhaps that really exceptional spiritual geniuses might have some wonderful attainment of liberation, but not us mere mortals. And so then we suffer because, you know, we can't really do it. And there's a whole school of Buddhism that believes that we're so far away from the time of the Buddha that it's actually impossible for anybody to get enlightened anymore. You know, we don't have the ability to fulfill the techniques anymore. It's a little bit depressing. But they have a solution to that, so it's okay. To the depression. What?
They have a technique to do.
No, they have. They're the Lutherans of the Buddhist world. They don't believe in good works, so they rely on grace. So it's all through the power of grace. But the wisdom approach. If you look at the Buddha is most commonly characterized, liberation or awakening, the goal of Buddhist practice, they use the word bodhi, which means to be awake. And to be awake is not the same thing as to attain or to become something different than who you are. And to be awake is kind of like, you know this famous thing out nowadays, or in recent times, the idea of thinking outside the box, you know, this expression? And so everybody's inside the box thinking, you know, what should I do here? And, you know, the solution's not in the box. You have to go outside the box to figure out the solution. Well, awakening is a little bit like that. The wisdom approach is a little bit like that. It's learning somehow to step outside the box, to see the whole box, to see the human life in a very different way, and find that it's possible to be happier right now. I think many people can intuit that truth, or there's some kind of deep knowing that they already have. Sometimes people will hear certain teachings or read a book, say, well, I never articulated it before, but I kind of knew this is true. Or there's some sense of knowing, intuitive sense of knowing inside, that you kind of know something. You know something is really profoundly, deeply true. You never articulate it, you don't know quite what it is, and you don't know how to apply it and make it work for your life. But you can kind of see something is really true right now, that you know. And perhaps it isn't so much a matter of years of technique that finally you can get something, but having some kind of mirror that can point back to you, for you, at what you already know. So sometimes people talk about coming home, that spiritual life is coming home to something they already know, something they already feel, or some sense. one of the fundamental delusions that awakening is supposed to dispel is the delusion that of becoming, of wanting to become something. And many people are driven by wanting to become something, wanting to become better in all kinds of ways, in reasonable ways, becoming better, but kind of thinking that their security, their well-being, their happiness, real love, real peace, is something that they can get in their life if they can become something that's worthy of it. Or if they can become a certain, you know, the most enlightened person on the block would be really great. And they find a lot of suffering in this world of Buddhist spirituality around people who relate their spirituality to wanting to become something. Their sense of identity, their sense of who they are as a person is tied into some attaining something and getting something, putting something in place. You know, maybe I can be a more compassionate person. It's a reasonable thing, it's a nice thing to want. But then we want to become that more compassionate person. That desire of becoming can have within it the possibility of tremendous suffering. Certainly to become different than who we are is a suffering many people chase after. And it's kind of unfortunate, you know. And I've known people who for years and years have chased after trying to be somebody that weren't, only to realize it wasn't going to work. They had to accept who they were. So becoming, wanting to become is considered a delusion that's to be dispelled. So that becomes a challenge for practice, especially for the skillful means approach, because it's about becoming. It's like making something into something different. And even if you don't identify necessarily with, for example, getting concentrated personally, like, oh, now I'm not a concentrated person, you're still trying to make something become, making something come into existence, a more concentrated state. And then to make it more challenging to us, the second big delusion is supposed to be dispelled. The first one is called bhava tanha. The second is called vibhava tanha. And V is a negative. So it's considered the desire for the non-existence of something, the non-becoming of something. So you thought you understood the first one, great. I just won't become anything. And then everything will be fine. But the desire not to become anything, not to be anything, is also a problem. So you know, maybe you have some kind of wonderful personality defect. You know, if I could only get rid of that one, then everything will be fine. That's vibhavata, that's desiring to get rid of something, a non-existence of something. Or some people don't want to have a certain identity. They're afraid of standing out in the crowd. They don't want people to notice them. So they try to shrink away or try not to have, you know, they don't want to be anything for anyone. And so they have this vibhava, they kind of, almost kind of annihilate themselves as a person to kind of, so they don't have to stand out and be threatened. They feel safer that way. So desire to become and to be and to attain is suffering, and the desire not to be or to unbecome, to be unbecoming, is suffering. So, what's left? And what's left is to wake up and to be awake. There's something about the nature of waking up which steps outside the box. And so you think, oh, great, that's a good idea. So, what do I do? I should go and I really need to, you know, give up my job and I need to go and find a wonderful retreat or a monastery to go in and really try for years and see if I can really get the right level of concentration so that I can be awakened and so I can step outside the box. Sounds good, right? But the wisdom approach sometimes says you can actually, you don't have to do that. It's easier than that. So what is that? What is it that's easier? What is it that's available right now? What is it that you can attain right now? And Not attain. I mean, it's not a matter of attainment. You have to kind of do away, the wisdom approach, you have to do away with all notions of wanting to attain anything at all, or to unattain, or to stop attaining. But rather to be awake. There's something about the nature of being wakeful, of being aware, of being attentive, of being present in the here and now, in the present, that helps us to step outside the box of our life and see it in a way so that we don't suffer, so we can be happy. One of the very remarkable things to do in mindfulness practice, it's very helpful for this stepping outside the box, is to be mindful of your thinking. And you'll be, if you stay really attentive, if you really track your thoughts and what your thinking does, you'll be really amazed. You'll be humbled, if you do it well. You'll probably be humored, I hope. Someone said, it's a blessing to be able to laugh at yourself, because then you'll never stop being humored. But to look at our thoughts very honestly and clearly, there's a very interesting thing that can happen. And that at some point, if you see them clearly enough, watch them carefully enough, you'll be convinced, you'll see clearly that your thoughts are not you. And if you can see your thoughts are not you, if you don't take this movement, or you see the difference between having a thought arises, and then the idea that this is my thought, the association, this is my thought, I'm thinking this means that about me, I'm thinking about what should I think about? I'm not thinking about anything much except the talk. I'm thinking about the talk, and I'm wondering how you guys are taking it. That's a reasonable thing for me to think about while I'm sitting here, right, giving a talk. So I think, how are these people taking this? That's a simple thought. And then I said, well, maybe they don't like this kind of talk. He probably didn't prepare this talk today. You know, this is not very respectful of a big audience of people. He should be more considerate and spend about a week writing the talk out, and looking at all the books and all the dictionaries and make sure that he really understands well and well organized. So I'm thinking, maybe they're thinking that about me. That's a reasonable thing to think about, since I didn't do those, and maybe I should have. So that's all very fine. But then I think, oh, I shouldn't be so self-conscious. I've been a Buddhist practitioner for so many years, and I shouldn't be concerned what other people think about me. And how could I have that kind of thought? And oh my God, you know, I'm the kind of person who thinks that way. And I got to do something about this, and let's get into, you know, I got to think in a different way. And maybe if I have positive thinking, maybe I should just kind of make affirmations as we're sitting here. They like this thought. They like this thought. You know, maybe that'll kind of help a little bit. Is it helping? So we very quickly, in very many ways, get entangled with our thinking. We think it's us, we think it says something about ourselves, our personality. And one of the delusions that you get liberated from in Buddhist liberation is the idea that you're going to take all these things personally. The belief in a personality, the personality belief it's called, Sakkaya Ditti. It's the first fetter which is eliminated with enlightenment, the stream enter. In a personality belief. So you take these things as being representative of your personality. This is you, who you are. It's not like not who you are, but it's not who you are. And to be able to see your thoughts floating by, say, oh, that's an interesting thought, and not do anything about it. Not associate it with yourself, not add on to it the idea, which takes effort and work, this is my thought. It seems very innocent to do that. But if you're very still, you can actually see that you can have a thought by itself, and there's no fabrication of anything but what that thought means, that it's present. No building of a self, adding of a self, no claiming that this is mine to that thought. It's just there. And it's possible to have the most awful thought in the world. It arises, you see it, and it passes, and nothing happens. It's possible to have the same thought and be so filled with embarrassment and terror that people see it or come to great conclusions about what this means about yourself. One of the wonderful teachings I got from my father growing up was when I was about 14, he pulled me aside for a father-son talk, and he said, "Son, as you grow up, there are going to be times when you have really bizarre thoughts. That's okay. Don't worry about it. Everyone does." Isn't that great advice? And sure enough, it has happened once or twice. An hour since then. And but I was freed by that little statement, a little bit of advice when in my formative period, I was freed from a lot of complicated ways of associating, reacting, and responding, and identifying with those kinds of certain ones of those thoughts from that statement. But as I started doing mindfulness practice and was able to watch my thoughts go by, it became much clearer. This thing, like your thoughts can come by. You don't have to identify. You don't have to take the thoughts as being so personal. And it's quite something to watch what your thoughts do, to carefully, to watch how thoughts create a whole universe of self and others and needs and fears. And if we don't track them and watch them clearly, then we think we believe them. But it's actually possible if you watch very great clarity of thought going by, you can actually be free completely of what that thought content is. Mindfulness is kind of like stepping outside the box of the world of thoughts and seeing them as not being necessarily part of who you are. Not making that association. This defines my personality. Not harden our personality around this thing being present. It isn't like you're going to disown them and say, "These don't belong to me." But you're not going to harden yourself and make some kind of conclusion, "This defines who I am." Our feelings are the same way. Our emotions are the same way. And learn not to take things so personally. I told this story a few weeks ago leaving some place where I paid for something, and after I left, I kind of thought, you know, I think I was cheated. And I decided I was already on the road in the freeway leaving, and I wasn't going to go back and try to confront and deal with the issue. But I was filled with these thoughts about, gee, you know, I wonder if I was cheated, and doing the calculations over and over again in my head, and reliving the conversations, and you know how I could have done it better, how I could have been more on top of it at the time, and well, maybe I should in the morning and I call the Better Business Bureau or someone, Chamber of Commerce, and do something about it, and I had all this anger, indignation, fear, shame, all these feelings about it. They all were set in motion very quickly. So I was driving along the freeway, aware of all that, and I saw that I had a choice, and the choice was to continue punching it out or not. But not punching it out didn't mean that I could drop it just like that and then drive down the freeway serenely. What it meant was not seeing this whole phenomena which was set in motion. This momentum was set up. I got myself into trouble. I set up all this momentum of reaction, and this momentum is going to have to live itself out. It's going to have to take its course. I'm not going to fuel it anymore. I'm not going to get involved anymore. But I can't stop myself from thinking these thoughts automatically just like that. But I'm just going to see this as being an impersonal process. It's like this. It's like someone made a big wave, and the wave is not, you know, pushed into the water, made a wave, and that wave is going to take its course through the lake until it kind of dissipates. What most of us do is we push the water, and then we run along after the wave and push it again, and push it again. But I'd already pushed the water once, or twice, maybe. And at some point I saw all this, and I said, you know, I'm not going to push the water anymore. But I can't stop thinking this way. I can't stop having my feelings. But I'm not going to see them as being, I'm not going to take them personally. I'm just going to let them run kind of in the background until they dissipate. Is that making sense what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And so it kind of dissipated by itself. If I'd gotten very much involved in kind of stopping them and letting go of them, it would have been another way of pushing the waves to continue. So the first, one of the first important insights that leads to freedom is the freedom, the insight into how this, what's called personality belief, operates, and seeing through it, seeing the way in which we harden ourselves, our sense of identity, around all kinds of things: our thoughts, our feelings, our emotions, our life experience, our status, our bank account, our car, our body, all kinds of things. And to see that that's just a belief. It's a belief system. It's a kind of a belief system that believes that these things represent who you really are. And it's not necessary to have that belief. So the first way of stepping outside the box is not to take all these things so personally. And it can even help with your suffering. The second thing that's insight that it comes with stepping outside the box is much more challenging. And that is no longer believing. And the word is, the Pali word is sila bhata, sila and bhata. And sila means ethics or virtue. And vata means something like religious observances, religious practices. And it's no longer believing that awakening or liberation is going to become directly through ethical practices or any other religious practices. So what does that do with Buddhism? I've been a good Buddhist, you know, for all these years, plugging away, doing my practices, you know, and I've been, if I do these things really well, if I live an ethical life really well, and if I do all these practices and build up and up, you know, then maybe I can get, you know, some kind of awakening. But the second fetter, which is eliminated, this belief that awakening can come through sila and vata. So where does that leave us? We should all go home and give up, right? The usual way of understanding this is that ethics and religious observances are actually very important. But they're not going to enlighten you. They're not going to bring out awakening. No way, Jose. They might make it easier for awakening to happen, but they're not going to cause it. They're not going to bring it about. Awakening doesn't belong. Awakening doesn't belong to the world of ethical practices and religious practices. Mindfulness, concentration, all these things. That's a pretty radical thing for these wisdom people to say. So maybe you're a, you know, skillful means person, so you're beginning to tune me out. But anyway, that's what the wisdom people will say. And so one of the first things that's stepping outside the box entails is to really see through these two beliefs: the personality belief and the belief that rites and rituals, sometimes translated as, are efficacious for the point of view of liberation. If you're able to track your thoughts carefully, you see them as thoughts and not see them as self, you'll feel a certain kind of freedom from them. And that'll give you a sense of how it's possible to step outside the box in all kinds of other things. Perhaps, you know, you can, if you go onto this, now as an adult, you go into the elementary school playground and some guy goes like this to you or says, you know, your mother wears army boots or something. What do you, you know, is your mind going to be ruffled by that? Some kid, some little, you know, third grader comes along and says, your mother wears army boots. Great. You know, he thinks it's kind of cute or whatever. You know, it's kind of, it doesn't really have the same impact as you when you were in third grade, perhaps, in me. And, you know, the last time I punched someone out, or say, the last time my punch connected to someone was in kindergarten. The schoolyard bully. He was chasing me, and I turned around and belted him. And then I ran to a teacher. Happiness is available right now. But there are obstacles for being happy. All kinds of obstacles. But all those obstacles only stand in the way of happiness if you believe they stand in the way of happiness. You don't have to get rid of those obstacles to be happy. You have to get rid of the idea that they're obstructing your happiness and step outside the box. There's something in the nature of knowing, of seeing very clearly what's happening in the present moment that allows us to step outside the box and be free and happy. Knowing doesn't require what you know to go away. If you then notice something about yourself and say, well, only if I got rid of that, then I'll be happy, then you fall into the delusion of vibhavatana, desiring something to be different. If you notice you're unhappy and you have some idea, if only I can get something else, get certain conditions in place, then I can really be happy, then you fall into another kind of delusion. The really radical challenge, and I call it radical challenge, the really radical challenge of the wisdom approach, is to really ask us to look really honestly at what we're actually doing in the present moment. And in that honesty, take refuge in the knowing of what we see. There's something about the knowing quality, the ability to know, which partakes of liberation, of freedom. You don't have to change anything in the world, any condition in the world, nothing has to be changed. But you have to be able to somehow be cognizant enough of awareness, cognizant enough of the knowing quality of what's going on, to feel the knowing itself is actually independent of what it's known. So you see those thoughts going by, and it's nice to see them going by, but you see that the knowing is unruffled by it. And you take, you trust, settle back into that knowing. The knowing itself becomes the place of safety and security, of happiness. And that the knowing is always here. But what happens to most of us is we get so quickly entangled with what we know. So the schoolyard bully tells you, as an adult, something about your mother's shoes, and nothing happens in your mind. But someone says something about your shoes, how could you wear shoes like that? Don't you know that Birkenstocks went out of fashion in 1982? And suddenly, oh my God. You know, and the mind is ruffled. We latch on. We've gotten hooked. And we've lost the refuge of knowing. Because we've gotten entangled in what we know, what's been said. To step outside the box and to live a free life is to have enough faith that it's possible to relax in the knowing, take refuge in the knowing. And always come back to that, no matter what is happening in your life, there's some safety to be, some happiness to be found in just knowing itself. I was almost reminded now, so I was talking to this fellow about happiness or whatever we were talking about, and my response to him, and I felt this man was a man of a lot of religious faith, a lot of spiritual faith, very devout person, and beautiful faith. And I told him before, and I told him again today, that I felt that he wasn't really, even though he had a lot of strong faith, he wasn't really allowing that faith to live in his life. He wasn't really allowing himself to be informed, be supported by that faith. And he kind of then started to protest. So then I came up with this analogy. I said, you're kind of like this. It's kind of like you're someone who has a lot of faith and confidence that it's possible to learn how to swim. You don't know how to swim, but you really have a lot of faith that it's possible. You really believe it. You're completely convinced it's possible to swim. And you spend a lot of time going around telling other people, it's really possible to swim. It's really, I know it's possible. And you should believe, and you should know it's possible that you can swim. But you never get in the water to learn. You never let your faith take you into the water, so the water, and then let the faith kind of, that faith in swimming and floating, allow you to kind of just float there in the water. Sooner or later, faith has to help us step outside the box of all the things that we know and see if it's possible to stay happy, stay at ease, stay contented, stay untouched, unchallenged by the conditions of the world. To stay open and vulnerable to the uncertainty of not knowing anything, not knowing how to respond. And what I've found is that... is this okay to keep talking? When I was a teenager, I wanted to had this idea of going off and becoming a Catholic monk, and I thought it was kind of interesting kind of vocation because I was an atheist, and I wasn't going to tell them that, but I really wanted to live that life, and I was pretty confident I'd fit in just fine. And because I grew up a little bit in Europe and would visit different monasteries and stuff, and I had a sense that there was some way of being, some sense of presence, some sense of knowing, some sense of silence that was all that I only thought was accessible in that life. A kind of feeling at home in the world, content with life, and unambitious, not needing to become anything for anyone or attain anything or anything, you know, in a goal or any way, ambitious kind of way, in a neurotic kind of way. Just live a simple life. And many years later, what I recognized is that that silence, that simplicity, that presence that I identified with, I had a sense of it. I kind of had some sense of knowing as a teenager of this possibility, was actually always present, is always present, it's always available. I've learned is that it seems to be most available when the surface thinking of the mind
skillful means pops up again.
Well, that's what I'm trying to avoid.
Good luck.
Well, well. Anyway, what I've learned over my years is that trusting, not needing to figure things out, not needing to think things out so much, and that just being present and not needing to figure things out helps the mind become quiet. And there still can be some thinking or knowing or intelligence operating, but that there's no need to have our thoughts chasing after all kinds of things to figure them out. There's a native and natural intelligence that will know how to do things quite well. So I don't know, maybe I have not demonstrated that. But that's the way it goes. And so I encourage you to kind of think outside the box, or not think outside the box, but yes.
I really wanted to hear about you just stop. And you're saying, I noticed that if I just something about the surface thought. And you didn't complete that thought.
Right.
I
want to
hear that.
Well,
yeah. Well, sorry, let me tell you.
Like,
no.
It was very fluid, and then you just
stopped.
Stopped.
I stopped myself. I just stopped the other way. Right. Let me tell you what happened to me at that moment. I was trying to express something, which I didn't have easy access to how to express. I'd never really articulated this so well before.
Right, that's why I was so interested in what you were going to
say. Me too.
That.
And nothing really came.
Oh.
Exactly. I found it hard to. I didn't know what to do next. What to say next? I mean, I knew intuitively what I wanted to say, but I didn't know quite how to say it. So I was kind of stopped briefly, and then it did occur to me when, in that moment, in that pause, what Lewis was laughing about, was that it was looked like it was going down the track of you need to kind of get rid of thinking, in order to, you know. So I was kind of humored by that. Oh, you know how easy it is to take that track, and Lewis picked up on it really well. So it was kind of it was kind of fun, I thought. But that was only one, you know. But what I was trying to articulate was my trust in not needing to know, and that in that not knowing, something deeper can sometimes be said, or maybe doesn't need to be said, or something. And so, in that silence, I was stopped by what I had to say, and it took me right back into that deeper mind, the deeper place. Where of trust, where I just had to trust that's, you know, what was going to happen next. Mm-hmm. And since I was giving a talk, I kind of hoped that something intelligent would come up and I would finish a sentence. But that place doesn't require the sentence to be finished. That place doesn't require me pleasing you all with a nice ending to a talk. It doesn't require anything. And the way that grace was operating was nothing was coming. That seems, you know, so it was just there without finish the sentence. So that's kind of what happened to me.
Okay. That's very helpful to see.
So, thank you for listening so well. Good night.